Thank you for listening.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of How We Got On at the Portland Playhouse, Wednesday through Sundays until October 25th. Directed by Jen Rowe, How We Got On is the story of three teenagers in the suburbs of the Midwest who dream of fame in the golden age of hip-hop in the late 80s. That's How We Got On, Wednesdays through Saturdays at 7:30 p.m. and Sundays at 2 p.m. through October 25th at the Portland Playhouse, 602 Northeast Prescott Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hip-hopping is the thing that's in. It's where the Stone Cold Nitro party begins. So listen, party people with the ear to the street, the college professor and the social elite, to the fly young guys and the pretty girl. IT is going to tell you about the hip-hop world. Hip-hopping is a way of life.
It's 11 o'clock and you're listening to KBOO Portland.
Thanks for tuning in to Intersections Radio, the show where we geek out on all things intersectionality. This month, I'm focusing on healthy living and social justice. I have two very special guests today. First up, United States Surgeon General Vivek Murthy. He talks about his call to action called Step It Up, which is encouraging walkable communities. Next, joining us live, Deanna Fay talks about her memoir, Girl in Glass. This is the story of her daughter's birth at 25 weeks, and then how her so-called distressed baby was blamed by AOL CEO Tim Armstrong as one of the reasons for employee benefit cutbacks. Finally, we close with another great deaf South Asian American story, some powerful insight from Smita Kothari. I'm Sarika Mehta, and you're listening to Intersections Radio. Last month, the United States Surgeon General Vivek Murthy issued a call to action called Step It Up. This initiative aims to promote healthy living by getting out and walking more. Of course, this requires access to walkable communities. For Intersections Radio, I spoke to him about Step It Up as it applies to communities of color and people with disabilities. Dr. Vivek Murthy, thank you so much for joining me on Intersections Radio.
Oh, it's great to be on with you.
Your call to action is called Step It Up. And there is no doubt to the importance or benefits of walking and walkable communities, but how do you intend to implement this plan in communities where safety is a concern?
Well, that's a great question. And I will say that for many people, actually, they don't realize the benefits of walking and that many of us face challenges when it comes to walkable communities. So that was an important point we tried to make yesterday. One, the point that walking is a great way to get physically active, to build an active lifestyle and reduce your risk of heart disease, diabetes, and other chronic illnesses. But we also raised the fact that there are many people who live in the country for whom walking outside is not a simple prospect. Three out of 10 people live in neighborhoods without sidewalks. Many people living with disabilities have a difficult time wheelchair rolling because their neighborhoods are not set up to accommodate people with disabilities. And safety, as you mentioned, is a concern for many folks and prevents people not only from walking but letting their kids go outside and walk to school or walk to the park. So these are all important issues. What we are doing through this call to action and over the coming months is putting a call out specifically to the communities that are involved in helping to build and plan neighborhoods. And so these are city planners, transportational professionals, local government officials, and nonprofits that work in the community. Because we know that if we want to make our communities safe, if we want to make them walkable, that's going to take the participation of multiple sectors, not just the medical and public health teams.
And what about walkable communities as a health equity issue, reaching out to communities of color? Talk about some of the challenges that you find in these situations and how you intend to reach everyone.
Yeah, well, health equity is an issue that is very important to me. It's one of the themes that runs through everything I will do as Surgeon General. And when it comes to walking, here too, we see inequities, where for people living with disabilities, it can often be harder for them to walk in neighborhoods. But we also know that levels of physical inactivity are higher for certain populations, including women, including the elderly, including Hispanics, as well as Blacks. And so what we have to do is to is to think about how we can create opportunities for everyone to walk, because I firmly believe that America should be a place where everyone has a safe place to walk or to wheelchair roll. So some of these efforts that we'll be rolling out over the coming months involve working with partner organizations that can bring a particular focus to working with communities of color, with the elderly, with people living with disabilities, to ensure that their voices are heard in our efforts to make America walkable.
You briefly mentioned about wheelchair accessibility. I want to talk more about accessibility. Folks with mobility disabilities or people who simply may not be equipped to walk as much due to injury or other such issues, aging populations. How do you reach out to these communities beyond what you've talked about so far?
Well, we have to make walking accessible for everyone. And as you point out, though, people walk in different ways. And some people walk with a wheelchair. Some people walk with a cane. People have different limitations as well. And that's why as we think about planning our communities, for example, as we think about what a healthcare practitioner says to a patient sitting in front of them about physical activity, as we think about the role that nonprofit organizations like the YMCA have in creating opportunities to walk, we have to make sure that our partners in different sectors also recognize the spectrum of abilities that people have and the fact that we need to cater to that spectrum and ensure that it's accommodated as we're planning out communities and as we're building our programs. Yesterday at our launch of the call to action, we had a number of partners join us, but one of them that who I'm remembering now is Juliette Rizzo, who's a wonderful leader and advocate. She was also Miss Wheelchair America in 2005, and she spoke eloquently about the importance of building cities and towns and neighborhoods in ways that accommodate all of us, regardless of our ability. That message is an important one for us to deliver to the country. And what we've already seen is that even in the first 24 hours, that their message has been received positively, and that there are communities across the country which are thinking about how to incorporate this message as they go to their city councils and local leaders and think about how to make their neighborhood a healthier and safer place.
Dr. Vivek Murthy, thank you so much for taking the time to join me on Intersections Radio.
Well, it's wonderful to be with you, and we're happy to get this message out about walking, and we want people to walk as much as they can for better health.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was United States Surgeon General Vivek Murthy joining me from his Washington, D.C. office.
Thanks again for joining us on Intersections Radio. Today, I have a very special guest, a friend to KABU. Deanna Fay is the author of the novel Thread of Sky and has previously joined us on KABU's APA Compass. Since then, she published her memoir, Girl in Glass, How My Distressed Baby Defied the Odds, Shamed a CEO, and Taught Me the Essence of Love, Heartbreak, and Miracles. In this book, Deanna gives an honest take of what it means to survive, when her daughter Mila arrived at 25 weeks and spent the next 3 months in the NICU, after which her husband's employer, AOL's CEO Tim Armstrong, publicly announced that due to two so-called distressed babies, AOL was going to make cuts to employee benefits. Deanna Fay joins me by phone from New York, and today we're going to talk about medical privacy as a civil right. Deanna, thank you so much for being on Intersections Radio today. Deanna, are you there? Deanna, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Thanks so much for having me.
So first, let's talk about, as I said, medical privacy as a civil right. First, bring us back to that day, the context of the situation, the announcement by Tim Armstrong, your reaction. Take us back to that day.
Yeah, it was a day when my daughter had actually just started to take her first steps. She had been home from the hospital for about a year, and I was finally starting to feel like maybe we were recovering from the trauma that we had suffered when she was born so early. And then that day, these headlines started to ricochet throughout the media universe about these distressed babies that were blamed for these cuts to retirement benefits for all employees at the company where my husband worked. And at first, my reaction was just to feel shame and the sense that maybe my daughter was a burden, that maybe I had done something wrong that, you know, caused the company to make cuts for everyone else. And then as this kind of snowballed into a huge media firestorm and this dehumanizing phrase, distressed babies, just kept showing up again and again in headlines and ironic tweets, and cable news discussions, it finally struck me that I need to speak out to defend my daughter, to defend her right to the care that saved her life, and also to show that no one deserves to get singled out for needing medical care, let alone a newborn baby.
Exactly. It was, from my end personally, it was so bizarre because, first of all, the announcement happened and that was already, you know, completely unfathomable. And then when we saw an interview with you, we know her. That's Deanna Faye. She's been on our show. I feel that, you know, we, to be honest, we live in this very litigious society. And I was shocked that Tim Armstrong kind of opened himself up in to this egregious error that way.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was shocking to so many Americans, to so many employees, to parents of babies who've needed medical care. But what I came to see after the controversy subsided, you know, I came forward, the story went viral, Tim Armstrong apologized, and I forgave him. But then I received this outpouring of messages from people just across the country who told me that in some way or another, they had also been shamed and blamed for their medical expenditures. And that really opened my eyes to this issue that so many of us need to really pay attention to. We think that we have medical privacy, and in fact, it's increasingly under threat in the society today. And I think what's so unusual, really, about what happened to me is that it happened on stage at a town hall meeting, and that it became the subject of countless headlines. But the fact is that people suffer this kind of violation of their basic civil rights day after day after day, and there's not a whole lot that's changed since my story became so public.
That's definitely something I wanted to talk about today, but just one moment before we get to that, for some clarification, AOL, that was your husband's employer, their benefits had covered, you know, what were they were required for your medical bills, and you mentioned that many times in the book that you were all grateful for that. So what is the incentive for CEOs to be safe, so to speak? I guess if you could give a point of clarification for what happens behind the scenes as far as the financial gain for CEOs who cover employee benefits, but without any catastrophic event.
Well, you know, it's a great question because this is something that's meant to be opaque to ordinary people. You know, these are decisions that get made behind the closed doors of corporate boardrooms. And generally, we have no idea how our insurance is actually paid for and how it's covered and how much it actually costs. In this case, Tim Armstrong came forward and slapped a price tag on my daughter. I've since learned from multiple experts, there's a consensus that he seemed to have been completely exaggerating, if not making up this $1 million price tag. That
right, he had put $1 million, he called it the $1 million baby or something.
Exactly.
Right.
And I think it's important to remember that he was at that point under fire for the cuts that he had made to retirement benefits when the company had just posted its best earnings in a decade. So at first he tried to blame Obamacare. That didn't really fly. So then he went after these two babies. I think, though, one of the larger issues that we really need to look at is that catastrophic events are the very basic purpose of health insurance. That's what health insurance is designed to cover. Nobody, no single individual can pay for the care that's required when you suffer a catastrophic event, such as getting hit by a car or suffering a spinal injury or having an extremely premature baby. This is part of basic employee benefits when health benefits are offered. And in many cases, such as AOL now, the incentives that are in play is that corporate bonuses are often directly pegged to their cost cutting. And so CEOs often have direct motivation to monitor employees' personal health, because that is a major item on the, you know, corporate balance sheets in terms of expenses for a corporation. And it's easy for them to target high cost individuals. But the truth is that any fiscally responsible health insurance plan should take into account that in any given year, someone might have a premature baby. And there seems to be a consensus that, you know, one, two, you know, three premature babies born to employees of a company such as AOL would not have actually driven up costs for the entire company. That's just not how insurance works. And so this was more of, you know, just a dishonest justification for corporate cost cutting, as opposed to a rational accounting of how these expenses actually play out for a corporation and its employees.
That is really something, because it's like you were saying, then if the bonus, if they're saying that the bonuses are tied to this, then of course there is incentive for higher ups in a company to monitor their employees' medical records, and or that is to say their health. They obviously cannot directly get access to medical records, but the crux of the issue is obviously that, you know, your privacy was violated, and it wasn't just you. After this incident, you had written a piece for Slate calling out the CEO, and then after which you received many letters and emails from other people who had experienced discrimination in the similar fashion. You had just mentioned that. Talk about some of these stories.
Yeah, I mean, these stories were hugely eye-opening and often heartbreaking. I heard from a mother of a premature baby who still cries every time she remembers how the insurance rep at the company stood up and said, well, rates are going up for everyone because someone had the nerve to have these premature babies. I heard from a woman who was fired after a cancer diagnosis and blamed for being too expensive. I heard from a father who was fired for no apparent reason other than that his baby had just landed in the NICU. And the harsh reality is that by law, our employers are not supposed to be able to access individual employees' medical records.
Precisely.
But the fact is they do. They often, in the age of electronic data, our CEOs often can look into the medical records of individual employees. And
well,
and
how can they access that if that's illegal?
Yeah, so some of this happens in a gray area of the law, and this is where the law is extremely complicated but also extremely outdated, because as all of our health information becomes increasingly digitized, it also becomes much more free-flowing, and in many cases the information goes straight from our providers to our insurers. In many cases now, our insurers are our employers. By law, the only people at our employers who should have access to that information are the people whose work directly concerns the health plan, such as human resources managers. But the reality is that the law is written so broadly, and the reality in any work space is that there are no clear boundaries. You know, what we think of as a firewall is actually extremely porous. The other thing is that, you know, by law, our health records are basically free game. You know, it's kind of a free for all once they've been so-called, they've been anonymized. That's the term of art, where names and addresses and identified details such as those have been stripped away. But my case showed just how easily these so-called anonymous medical records can be, in some cases, immediately and very often very easily traced to specific individuals. Once you're talking about, you know, medical conditions that such as a premature baby, or a rare form of illness, you know, a cancer. It's not difficult at all for people who share a workspace, with people who share supervisors, to very easily identify the individuals in question. And that often leaves those individuals open to the exposure of profound trauma, physical and emotional trauma. It leaves them open to this culture of blame for being, quote unquote, expensive, for needing medical care. And it leaves them open to getting fired for their medical expenditures in the most extreme instances.
Absolutely. And have you heard of other cases of people who have been presumably let go from their jobs, fired from their jobs for a medical reason, for being considered so-called too expensive? Have you heard of any cases where people have fought back or any kind of lawsuits or anything like that?
That's a great question. I do know of a couple of cases that have made the news. A man who worked for Wells Fargo, who was fired in just such blatant fashion right before his daughter was scheduled to undergo expensive cancer surgery. So his insurance was revoked, and his daughter actually died because they were waiting for a new insurance plan to kick in, which never did. I think that case is still wending its way through the courts. In most cases, it's extremely hard for any individual to fight back. When you're talking about violations of medical privacy, these are people who often are still struggling to recover from devastating medical events. They are in fear of losing their jobs. They can't jeopardize their paychecks, let alone their health insurance policies, which come through their jobs. And I'm extremely fortunate in that I was able to speak out to defend my daughter. I'm fortunate that my husband was able to leave the company on his own terms after the controversy. But I recognize that most people are not as fortunate, and the damage from these violations of medical privacy are often devastating.
In fact, that brings me to my next question. I couldn't help but think about how this issue is complicated for folks who may not have access to advocacy or know their rights, more marginalized communities, or even people who do know their rights, but are, as you were saying, just are not in a position where they can fight back or have access to, you know, media, for example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a great point. Medical privacy is an issue of civil rights. It's an issue of social justice. And the people who tend to be most vulnerable are women, parents, people with disabilities. And it is extremely hard for most people to fight back. But it's also a question of policy. By law, victims of medical privacy violations can report these violations to the Office of Civil Rights. But there's little incentive to do so. If there are any financial penalties that are assessed, those are paid directly to OCR, not to the victims. There's very little transparency in terms of what happens once people report these violations. And it seems that apart from, you know, a few $1 million penalties for huge data security breaches, in most cases that I think any ordinary person would recognize as an egregious violation of medical privacy, the penalties tend to be slaps on the wrist, you know, retraining of staff, rewriting of forms. So as it stands now, there's simply not a lot of incentive and a whole lot of downside for people to come forward and essentially take on the role of whistleblower against their own employers.
Of course. What would you like to see happen? We're talking about health privacy, medical privacy as a civil right. What would you like to see happen ideally?
I mean, I think the first thing that needs to happen is we need to recognize the scope of the problem. There's so much shame and silence that surrounds these issues. And what I hear again and again from people who have been targeted for their medical bills is the word shame. They feel shame for having been victims of medical crises, as if that's something that we can all control. They feel shame for being, quote unquote, expensive, as if the costs of care are, you know, their own fault, as opposed to the result of how our health care industry is structured. And they're terrified of being considered unemployable in the future. So we don't have much understanding of just how often these violations occur, but I know from my own inbox and these stories that continue to pour in every day that they are certainly much more common than we would like to think, and that we are all vulnerable to this kind of exposure. So I think, you know, we need to encourage people to speak up when this happens. And we also need to understand something that's actually very difficult to understand, which is that right now we're kind of up against armies of lobbyists whose interests lay in keeping our health data as valuable commodities that we don't really have any control over. So what we need is federal law to safeguard our right to health privacy. Originally, when HIPAA was passed, that's the law that
protects our privacy,
speaking,
right?
Yeah, governs our health privacy as well as other issues concerning healthcare. There was supposed to be the right of consent, which basically means that we should be able to authorize, entities to look into our health records for the purposes of treating us as patients. That was actually stripped out of the law by the Bush administration.
That brings up a whole another set of issues.
Exactly. And so since then, you know, we tend to think that we have privacy because we have to sign all those notices at doctor's offices.
Right.
But the truth is we have very little control over our own health information. And for as long as that's the case, we are vulnerable to getting discriminated against for our medical records.
Absolutely.
On the basis of our medical records, I should say.
I'm so sorry. We're running out of time. I hope your family and your children are doing well.
Thank you so much. Mila's just, she's the toughest little creature I've known. She teaches me about resilience every single day, and
Absolutely.
She's celebrating her third birthday next week. So, it's a happy ending for us, but I'm haunted by how vulnerable so many people are, and I think this is an issue that we all need to understand. Health privacy is something that I think can sound abstract and theoretical, and in
right.
fact, for all of us, our health information is the most sensitive information that's out there, and it is very out there for most of us at this point in time.
Exactly. Deanna, thank you so much for chatting with me for Intersections Radio.
Thank you so much.
Deanna Fay is the author of Girl in Glass, How My Distressed Baby Defied the Odds, Shamed a CEO, and Taught Me the Essence of Love, Heartbreak, and Miracles. I'm Sarika Mehta. Thanks for listening. Just recently, the deaf community in India gained a huge victory. They won the right to autonomously running the Indian Sign Language Research and Training Center. Above all, their existence and language are validated. So I want to close the show with some insight from deaf South Asian American Smita Kothari. Vidyut Late provided voiceover. This is a short clip from an interview in which Smita shared the sentiments of being treated as less than for her deafness while growing up in Bombay and the big difference in the US.
I feel the same way. I agree. Hearing South Asian people who are not aware, they think that being deaf means we are handicapped. They look down on us. They think we were punished by God. That's the mentality. They think there is so much we can't do. And they are always telling us, you can't, you can't, you can't do it. As deaf people, we ask, why can't we do that? But hearing people in India disagree. When I first moved here to the US, wow. I mean, I was just amazed. I was so shocked that American people seem to know they are supposed to still respect deaf people. If they want to communicate with a deaf person and they can't understand them, they'll offer pen and paper. They won't ask for the deaf person's parents to speak for them. Most of the time, I have experienced communication breakdowns. And even though I will use pen and paper so people can understand me, but some people don't know how to write in their own language. So I just leave it.
That's it for Intersections Radio. Thank you so much to my guests, United States Surgeon General Vivek Murthy, Deanna Fay, and Smita Kothari. Thank you, Vidyut Latte, for lending your voice. And thank you so much to my engineer, Liz Rogers. Catch Intersections Radio the first Friday of every month at 11 a.m. right here on KBOO. For podcasts, archives, transcripts, and video, visit intersectionsradio.wordpress.com and join the community at facebook.com/intersectionsradio. I'm Sari Gametha. Thanks for listening.
This is KBOO Portland. The time is 11:30 a.m. Coming up next, we hear an excerpt from The Scholar's Circle asking, is humanity the most damaging predator on Earth? The guests say yes, and that its predatory practices may be disrupting evolution. Let's have a listen.
Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian.